From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Since the start of the war, Palestinians in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip have been living under 24-hour curfew. On today's Fresh Air, we phone Dr. Saeb Erekat, a Palestinian professor in the West Bank, and ask what life is like for him and his family under curfew. Also, Moshe Fogel of the Israeli Defense Force tells us why the Israeli government thinks the curfew is necessary. Classical music critic Lord Schwartz plays the music he turned to after the start of the war. And we talk to the musician he turned to, cellist Yo-Yo Ma. And comic strip artist Bill Griffith tells us how he's responding to the war in his strip Zippy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A spokesman for President Gorbachev told the BBC that the extra troops sent to the Baltic republics earlier this month had already either been removed or were about to leave. The troop reductions are in accordance with a pledge given by Foreign Minister Alexander Besmertnik to American leaders. The BBC's Tim Huell reports from Moscow.
Spokesman Sergei Grigoryev said all the extra paratroops sent to the three republics earlier this month had already been withdrawn, and other troop reinforcements belonging to the Interior Ministry were currently being pulled out. He said the move was in line with a pledge given by Mr. Besmertnik to President Bush to withdraw some troops in order to renew dialogue with Baltic leaders, but he denied it was intended as a concession to American feeling. He said the move was dictated entirely by domestic considerations, the need to normalize the situation in the Baltic after what he called the tragic events of recent weeks, in which 20 people have been killed in violence by troops. The withdrawals have not yet been confirmed by the authorities in the Baltic. A spokesman for the Lithuanian parliament in Vilnius said two columns of military trucks had left the city, although there were no signs yet of a general withdrawal.
The BBC's Tim Huell. Lithuanian President Vytautas Landsbergis acknowledged today that some Soviet troops have left Vilnius, the capital city, but he said many sites are still occupied. He warned that Western governments shouldn't be taken in by promises that Moscow will withdraw its troops. The Soviet Interior Minister Boris Pugo said that all paratroopers have already been withdrawn from the Baltics, along with two-thirds of the ministry's Black Beret commandos. Landsbergis told reporters that a Soviet troop withdrawal could be the key to renewed negotiations with the Kremlin. U.S. military officials say last night's Iraqi ground incursion into Saudi Arabia has left around 20 Allied troops dead, including 12 Marines. NPR's Deborah Wong in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, has more.
A spokesman for the U.S. Central Command has announced that Iraq launched four separate incursions into Saudi Arabia last night, two near the coastal town of Khafji and two more about 20 miles inland. The incursions involved an undetermined number of Iraqi tanks, armor, and infantry. Pool reports from the front say the Iraqis engaged Saudi Arabian and Qatari forces, along with troops from the U.S. 1st Marine Division. Air Force bombers, marine attack planes and helicopters, and tow anti-tank missiles were used to rebuff the Iraqis. The Allies suffered less than 20 casualties, according to the U.S. spokesman, while Iraqi losses were said to be high. The spokesman said that fighting is still going on around Khafji between Saudi Arabian troops and an Iraqi mechanized battalion. I'm Deborah Wong in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
Prices were up sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 50 points to close at 2,713. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The White House is trying to downplay the importance of a joint U.S.-Soviet communique that appeared to link the Arab-Israeli conflict with the war in the Gulf. The statement, issued yesterday, said that Iraq could still end the Gulf War by withdrawing from Kuwait, and the communique pledged that after the war, the U.S. and the Soviets would work toward a comprehensive Middle East peace. That drew an angry response from Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, who accused the U.S. of not consulting Israel. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater insisted that the statement merely demonstrated unity between the superpowers and does not link the two conflicts. After a 10-week legal battle, the Army has settled with an avowed gay soldier who will be entitled to full back pay and retirement benefits, even though the military tried to dismiss him for his homosexuality. Carol Levinson reports.
Harry Watkins of Tacoma, Washington, told the Army he was gay when he was drafted 24 years ago. 14 years later, despite promotions, the Army moved to discharge Watkins the same year it initiated its ban against homosexuals. In 1989, a federal court of appeals ruled against the Army. Late last year, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the case, paving the way for this week's settlement. Watkins advises other homosexuals who disclose their sexual orientation to the military to do so officially.
They need to specifically require and get in writing that, you know, the decision is yours, Uncle Sam. You make up your mind whether you want me or not. And if you choose to keep me, then we're not later going to be going through this.
Watkins is retiring from the Army, but says he will continue to work to abolish the Army's ban against homosexuals. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson reporting.
The government's main tool for measuring the economy showed a slight improvement in December. The Commerce Department reported that its index of leading indicators rose by 0.1%. That was enough for some analysts to take as an indication that the recession may ease in several months. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As soon as the war in the Gulf began, the Israeli government instituted a round-the-clock curfew in the occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. This clampdown comes 3 years into the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation. The Israeli government is afraid that without a curfew, Palestinians, many of whom have aligned themselves with Saddam Hussein, would escalate their rebellion and participate in acts of terrorism against Israelis. We'll hear a more complete explanation a little later from an Israeli Defense Force spokesperson. But first, to find out what life is like today in the occupied territories, we call Dr. Saeb Erekat. He's a political science professor at Amaja University. He serves on the boards of the Palestinian Human Rights Center in Jerusalem and the Palestinian Cultural Association. He's also a founding member of the Arab-Palestinian Writers Association. He spoke with me earlier today from his home in Jericho. I asked him to describe the restrictions he's now living under on the West Bank.
15 minutes after war started in the Gulf, and exactly at 2:30 in the morning of January 17th, we heard Israeli vehicles roaming our town here and the rest of the West Bank and Gaza, imposing curfews and telling us word by word that if you leave the doors of your home, you'll be shot at with real bullets. Today, it's been 14 days, and 1.7 million Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have been confined to their homes. The psychological impact of putting 1.7 million people, including women and children, under this house arrest for such a prolonged period has been also enormous. I'm a father of two twin daughters who are 8 years old. I have never seen my daughters act in the way they're acting now. They hardly talk to each other now. They fight, they scream. And because I'm scared for their lives, I don't want them to play in the backyard or in the front yard because I'm afraid that they'll be shot at. So this devastating impact on Palestinian life has been enormous. And the irony of it, that we are civilians at times of war and in accordance with the 4th Geneva Convention. The world should say something, and to our surprise, we have not heard one comment, neither from the Secretary General of the UN, or from the Red Cross, or from the United States government, or the other Western government, which to us means that have the world stop seeing us even.
How many hours a day does the curfew apply to? Which hours are you free to leave the house?
We are not allowed to leave. It's a curfew that goes on for 24 hours continuously. Now, in the past 14 days, we were given two times to go and shop, 2 hours each. But mind you that the sources of supply have been cut. I mean, farmers cannot go and harvest and get to the market. People cannot work, so they don't have the money to buy the stuff. In terms of doctors, even doctors don't have permissions to go around to see their patients. And I'm talking about a curfew that is imposed 24 hours a day, continuous for the last 14 days.
So you've only had two different periods of 2 hours to leave the house? Do you have food in your house?
Yes, we have food in our home. I mean, I'm a professor, and my salary is good, and I can buy. But honestly, even that me as a professor, you know, I don't know if this curfew will continue with the whole duration of war. And the Americans and the British are saying that war may take months. I won't be able to buy food in the next 2 weeks because I can't get my salary.
How do you think that the curfew, the crackdown during this war, is going to affect relationships between Arabs and Jews within the peace movement?
Well, I think this war had changed so many things. We have seen that the peace movements in Israel, I've heard some reports yesterday, and I heard some of their spokesmen that I know very well have sent letters to peace movements in Europe asking them not to demonstrate against the war. And it was shocking for me to hear Peace Now or peace activists advocating the continuation of war and the continuation of devastation and telling the whole world that settlements of political disputes can only be done by war. And this is contrary to what we stood for. We stood for that a political solution can be reached in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And now the peace movements in Israel, I think they have failed their first test.
But they feel that they are under attack in a war that they didn't want to join. They didn't want to join this war, yet Saddam Hussein has made it very clear that he is considering using chemical weapons against Israel, and he's already used conventional weapons against
Israel. Well, we have been also, as Palestinians, under so much attack by the Israelis. We had 1,300 people killed in the past 3 years, 80,000 wounded. We had thousands in jails without trials even. But if we want to use to restore to our emotions and to abandon our sanity and advocate, armed struggle, that is an easy answer to do. This is why, peace is a commitment. Once you say that you stand for peace, once you stand for in the peace camp, you should know one thing, that peace is much more difficult than war. War is something so easy. It's easy to start. And those who think peace should know that the struggle is so difficult and so hard. And sanity should never be abandoned. And when I say that the Israeli peace movements had failed the first test, it showed that their commitment was so weak and so shaken by what's happening. I know that war is ugly. I know that this war may slide into a total disaster at the end if nobody can stop it. But nevertheless, once you put a commitment to peace, it means taking the hard choice.
We've been hearing about the enthusiasm expressed by Palestinians every time a Scud missile hits in Israel. From your perspective, living in the West Bank, is there that enthusiasm?
Yes, I heard it myself, but I talked to people about it, and the reaction I got, you should know that Palestinians have suffered more than enough. I mean, people tell me that, for the past 3 years, they have demolished 400 homes. In the past 3 years, they have not only demolished 400 Palestinian homes, but they also wounded 80,000 Palestinian youths and killed 1,300 Palestinians and uprooted 85,000 trees. They prevented our children from going to schools, and they continued to close universities for the past 3 years. And they say that maybe that this will awaken them, because I think this amount of suffering that the Israelis have inflicted on the Palestinians have prompted this reaction, this gut reaction. But people should know that 90% of all casualties of any war will always be civilians.
Can you explain the popularity of Saddam Hussein among Palestinians?
I think it's one simple explanation. If we go back to August 1st, one day before the outbreak of war, Palestinians were left alone, abandoned. Everybody turned their back on the Palestinians. Even Secretary of State James Baker, when he was mad at the Israelis, he told them, "You can call me at the White House when you're ready for peace." And yet, we were left alone under the mercy of a Shamir Sharon government with one objective in mind, to bring the West Bank and Gaza to a point of no return as far as settlements and demography are concerned. Should I remind you of the massacres committed in the past years against Palestinians? And then comes a voice, any voice, telling the Palestinians, "I will end your suffering, I will solve your problem." Saddam did that, where everybody else failed to do. So don't expect the Palestinians to turn their back on someone who offers them hope. Because if President Bush would come and say, "I will end Palestinian suffering and I will put an end to their occupation and I will work for their freedom," believe me, he will be also having a lot of popularity amongst us.
But isn't
I think one of the lessons that should be learned from this war is that maybe and only maybe the Palestinians should not be left without hope.
But isn't it clear that Saddam Hussein is a tyrant who's using the Palestinians in a very opportunistic way?
I think that's what I told you. When people when the whole world decided to leave the Palestinians and leave them in the cold and turn their back on them, and comes a voice who tells you, I'm going to solve your problem. Okay, you will have to say, okay, I'm going to test that. And the point is at a time when Mandela was meeting with de Klerk in South Africa, at a time when Germany was being reunified, at a time when we as Palestinian moderates were speaking of a dialogue between us and the Israelis in Cairo, at a time when Secretary Baker was trying to start a peace process, comes a government of Israel, headed by Shamir, and said no to everything, and said the River Jordan to the Mediterranean are the boundaries of Israel, meaning that only by the sword shall this region live. I mean, this by itself created a vacuum, a political vacuum, because now Palestinian moderates were discredited by Shamir, the American administration was discredited by Shamir, President Mubarak was discredited by Shamir, and this vacuum was filled by Saddam. And it's so obvious that now the Palestinians are being used by the Egyptians, by the Iraqis, by the Syrians, by the Saudis, by the Israelis. Everybody's raising now the Palestinian banner, which shows the extent and the necessity to start addressing the Palestinian question with the required elements.
Dr. Arakat, do you and your family have gas masks?
No.
How come?
Well, this is one of the ironies that when we hear sirens that missiles are hitting or somebody coming, you know, my daughters come to me and ask me, how come you didn't buy us gas masks? Try to answer this question for them. What shall I tell them? What shall I say? Shall I tell them that for four months, I approached the UN agencies, I approached the Red Cross, we approached everybody, all the consul generals here, foreigners and so on, telling them, we want to buy gas masks. And yet, we were denied this right by the Israelis.
I thought you were allowed to buy gas masks.
What?
I thought Palestinians weren't going to be given gas masks, but they would be allowed to buy gas masks.
We were not allowed to buy gas masks or given gas masks. There was a decision of the Israeli High Court one day before the war to distribute gas masks on the Palestinians who live in villages that are close to the Green Line, the 67 line. And the Israeli commander said, no, we don't have that many gas masks, and we will do our best. But believe me, I have a family here, a pregnant wife, two daughters, a son who's 3 years old, myself, my old father, we all without gas masks. And I would have bought them. Believe me, I would have bought them, because I know that my children would have asked me this question, and they did, and they are asking this question.
Let me get back to something we were talking about before. You said that you felt that the Israeli peace movement was failing the test in the sense that with a war breaking out and violence being directed against them, they've lost that mission of peace, and they're now in support of this war. But the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising, has also been a movement that uses violence in its opposition to the Israeli government.
Well, I don't know why you say that, because we have been having an Intifada urging people day after day, hour after hour, not to use guns. And guns were not used, maybe a few incidents in the past 3 years. Palestinians accepted to die alone for the past 3 years. Chairman Arafat was sending letters signed with his name here, urging Palestinians not to use guns. And the restraint shown up by the Palestinians in the Intifada is unprecedented. And I don't know how, you know, where do you get such information to say that violence? I mean, when somebody decides to confront Israel with the most advanced technology in the Middle East, with the most backward technology the humans had ever knew, the stone, it's a clear message from Palestinians. It's telling the Israelis and the world, kill me or free me. It's a cry for freedom. And Palestinians did not use guns, and we advocated and we continue to say, do not use guns. The whole world knows about this. In the Intifada, no guns were used. There were few, very, very, very few isolated incidents here and there.
One last question. Do you know when the next time will be that you'll be allowed out of the house?
I think so far I think it's going to be in 3 days.
And how do they let you know?
They announce it in the microphone.
Dr. Arakat, I want to thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure, man. Thank you very much for the interview.
Dr. Saeb Arakat is a Palestinian professor living on the West Bank. Why does Israel feel a 24-hour curfew for the Palestinians in the occupied territories is necessary? We'll ask Moshe Fogel of the Israeli Defense Force after the short break. This is Fresh Air. After we spoke with Saeb Erekat about life on the West Bank under 24-hour curfew, we called Moshe Fogel in Jerusalem to find out the reasons for the curfew. He's press spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Force.
Since the start of the war, we've imposed a curfew, which has basically meant that people can go out shopping for daily for supplies, and health care is taken care of, and ambulances operate, and clinics operate, as well as essential services such as bakeries and other supplies, but that persons have to be confined to the area where they live so that we are not faced with a threat of terrorism or violence aimed at supporting Saddam Hussein, as stated by the residents themselves, who said that if there would be a war, they would go out into the streets or go out and perpetrate terrorist attacks against Israel. So the main purpose and goal of the curfew has been to prevent that type of violence.
How is the curfew being enforced?
Basically, anyone who breaks the curfew can be fined or tried up to 3 months in prison. But 3 months is the maximum sentence, and this is only for someone who flagrantly violates the curfew.
Is there the threat of being shot if you violate the curfew?
By no means. In fact, through the entire period of time when there has been a curfew, I think there's been one or two cases in which there was some type of firing which occurred.
Since Palestinians can't leave their homes long enough to work, that means that there's no income coming in. What are Israeli concerns over Palestinians maintaining income and being able to buy food when they're allowed out of the house to shop?
We have a welfare officer, and we have all the welfare services which are designed to meet the needs of the Palestinians, so that we have no evidence whatsoever of anyone who can who is hungry or is in need and is not taken care of. There are a wide variety of organizations operating in the territories who provide voluntary assistance, and the civil administration is also very active in making sure that there's no one who goes hungry and there's no one who is in need that does not receive assistance.
What kind of allowances are being made for medical care under the curfew? Are doctors allowed to pay visits to patients, or sick people allowed to go to clinics or hospitals?
Doctors have special permits which allow them to move freely during the curfew. All clinics operate normally, and the hospital and clinical staff receive special passes to be able to work in the hospitals, and all the services, including ambulance services, operate absolutely routinely and normally without any interference. Let me just add that farmers are allowed to go and harvest their crops, and people are allowed to run their services and businesses if they are vital to the economy, such as bakeries and those types of services.
The question has been raised, how does a democracy like Israel justify depriving civilians of basic civil liberties?
We're talking about a belligerent occupation of a belligerent population. We're talking about people who affiliate themselves with the forces trying to attack us. So Arab Israelis, Muslim and Christian, are just like Israelis, free to move around. It has nothing to do with anyone's civil rights. But if there is one civil right that that people should have, it's the right to defend themselves. And I think that the people of Israel have that right to at least defend themselves against the potential of terrorist attack. And we saw that when dozens of Katyusha rockets were fired last night at Israel from Palestinian and PLO positions in Lebanon.
You're saying that Israel is enforcing this curfew to prevent violent uprising against Israel or sabotage of Israel, but is it unfair to enforce that upon people who aren't part of an organized movement and who aren't planning violent acts against Israel, because all Palestinians in the occupied territories are being affected equally by this?
We have very, very solid information, and it doesn't take any military expert to understand that a large population of over a million Palestinians who are belligerent and have expressed their design and their goal to see the end of the state of Israel, who affiliate themselves openly in mass demonstrations with Saddam Hussein, who cheer and express avid support for Saddam Hussein with every missile that falls in Tel Aviv, and who we know plan also subversive terrorist attacks within the state of Israel, then we think we have the right to defend ourselves. And in this case, we recognize the exceptional nature of the curfew. But it's also we're living in exceptional times, and I think that if we have daily missile attacks on the heart of the state of Israel, we have a right to defend ourselves, and including against the Palestinian population who have expressed their joy and glee for every missile that falls on the state.
The Israeli government gave gas masks to all Israeli citizens, but the Palestinians in the occupied territories were not given gas masks. What was the reason for that policy, and were they able to purchase gas masks?
The territories have never, ever been a target for any military or terrorist attack. So over the years, they've never been discerned, and they've never seen themselves as a target of any other Arab country. So there was never any civil defense apparatus established in the territories. Only recently have we seen some type of possibility that they would be hurt by any type of conflict. So we never planned to distribute gas masks because we never saw them as a potential target. Only recently has that problem arisen. And what we've done is we've gone and purchased about 180,000 gas masks. We're manufacturing more. And we've begun a distribution of those gas masks along the Green Line, along the 1967 border with Israel, to make sure that, first of all, those Palestinian Arabs living along the Green Line will have gas masks. And if a missile does, by mistake, fall in their vicinity, at least they will be protected. In addition, we hope to broaden the distribution to include the general population of the territories. But at the same time, we won't be able to do the same thing within a period of months that we've done over a period of more than 20 years in which we've accumulated gas masks and built a civil defense apparatus for the people of Israel. So we don't think that the situation is comparable. We still don't think they're a target, but we recognize our need and our responsibility to defend them in case, by some mistake, a missile lands in their area.
Were Palestinians allowed to purchase gas masks?
Palestinians are allowed to purchase gas masks, but we're not, at this point, even requesting that they purchase it. We're distributing the 180,000 gas masks at no cost. If they want to privately purchase gas masks, that's their business.
Moshe Fogel is a press spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Force. He spoke to us earlier today from Jerusalem. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, wasn't in the mood for a concert after the war started, but he went anyways, and he was glad he did. Coming up, he tells us about a very moving performance featuring cellist Yo-Yo Ma, and Lloyd has excerpts of the performance to play for us. And we call Yo-Yo Ma to find out what music he's been turning to during the first weeks of the war. Yes, but what does Zippy the Pinhead think of the war? We talk with his creator, comic strip artist Bill Griffith. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to pool reports from Saudi Arabia, Iraqi forces are apparently still in control of the border town of Kafji after a day of surprise cross-border attacks by Iraqi troops. As night fell, the area around the town shook with the noise of artillery bombs as Saudi troops, supported by U.S. gunfire, fought to oust Iraqi forces. Ground fighting in the area has been the heaviest since the start of the Persian Gulf War. In New York City, the U.N. Secretary General has replied to a verbal attack from Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz with a statement urging Baghdad to make a serious effort toward a peaceful solution to the Persian Gulf crisis. Linda Fasulo has more from the U.N.
In a letter to the Iraqi Foreign Minister, Perez de Cuellar said that the U.N. was not seeking Saddam's surrender, but the most honorable way of resolving the Gulf War. Downplaying Iraq's verbal assault, the UN chief said he viewed it with regret and rejected its implications. The letter from Baghdad last weekend held the Secretary General personally responsible for what it called heinous crimes committed against Iraq. But the UN chief's response focused on the prospects for peace and urged Saddam to abide by Security Council resolutions and withdraw from Kuwait. In a hint of linkage to the Palestinian issue, he added that he was prepared to work with Iraq and others in the region to find a lasting solution to the problems of the Middle East. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
A number of members of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization are putting together a force of maritime patrol planes to monitor the Mediterranean and ensure the safety of its sea lanes. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports from London.
A NATO spokesman in Brussels said maritime patrol aircraft will be sent to the Mediterranean to conduct training and surveillance to ensure freedom of navigation and safe passage. Sources said Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, and Turkey will send planes, while Britain, Spain, Greece, and France intend to coordinate their flights with the alliance. Seven alliance ships are already sailing for the Mediterranean to help guard against mines. When NATO announced it was sending the ships on the day war broke out in the Gulf, it said the action was to protect the safety of shipping and freedom of navigation in that vital area. In London, this is Sylvia Pagioli.
Jordan's foreign minister says that U.S. airplanes bombed civilian traffic near the border with Iraq and that four Jordanians and one Egyptian was killed. He said that these air attacks occurred in Iraq near the highway linking Baghdad with the Jordanian capital. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 50 points to close at 2,713.12 on volume of some 227 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 3-1. This is NPR News. According to reports, truckloads of Soviet troops have left the capital of Lithuania, but the president of the Soviet Republic says that many sites are still occupied. The Soviet Interior Minister says that all paratroopers have left the Baltic region, and two-thirds of the Black Beret troops have been pulled out. President Bush said yesterday that he had been assured that Soviet officials are cutting back a military presence in the area and planning to restart talks. 19 people have died in recent Soviet crackdowns in Lithuania and Latvia. On Capitol Hill, the Senate has joined the House and voted to approve a bill that would give permanent benefits to Vietnam War veterans suffering from the effects of exposure to Agent Orange. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Agent Orange is a chemical defoliant used by U.S. troops in Vietnam to destroy jungle foliage that was being used as cover by the enemy. Many veterans say exposure to the major ingredient in Agent Orange, dioxin, caused cancer and birth defects in their children. For 20 years, a debate has raged over whether Agent Orange was, in fact, responsible for the veterans' illnesses. The vote in Congress this week does not settle that debate, but it does provide special benefits to Vietnam War veterans suffering from specific ailments, such as chloracne, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and soft tissue sarcoma. The veteran survivors would also be eligible for benefits. President Bush has said he supports the legislation and will sign the bill into law. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
In Athens, Greece, the Supreme Court has banned publication of all terrorist statements after a newspaper printed one group's claim that it attacked Western interests to protest the war against Iraq. The order was given after an Athens Daily published a letter from a group claiming responsibility for attacks on U.S., British, and French interests. Officials in Turkey say that gunmen killed the chief advisor to the prime minister's office today. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says he's been moved by the way musicians in Boston, where he lives, have responded to the war. Lloyd says he's sure that in a time of crisis, great art becomes more, not less, important.
The night after the first Scud missile hit Israel, I wasn't much in the mood for music. But one of my favorite groups, the Cantata Singers, was doing one of my favorite pieces, Arnold Schoenberg's choral work, Friede auf Erden, Peace on Earth. So I went. Conductor David Hoos led an unusually clear and unusually impassioned performance. There was a warm round of applause. Then an amazing thing happened. The applause wouldn't die down. The audience began to stand, one by one. There were handkerchiefs in many hands. It's as if it were slowly dawning on us what this sublime, spiritual music really meant, and how much we all needed to be there together, listening to it. Then, without even looking at us, Hoos returned to the stage and signaled the chorus to sing it again. This time, we all understood from the beginning. The Cantata Singers' concert had been planned long before war broke out, but it was clear that in some deep way the music was responding to the world crisis, that making and listening to music was a way of responding to world crisis. 2 days later, there was a benefit concert by the Boston Philharmonic. This is a remarkable community orchestra conducted by Benjamin Zander. The special guests were Yo-Yo Ma, who has performed with Zander numerous times, and pop star Bobby McFerrin, who conducted the orchestra in a jubilant performance of the scherzo movement of the Beethoven Ninth Symphony. Then Ma and McFerrin teamed up for duets and improvisations. Yo-Yo Ma played the Ave Maria on the cello, while Bobby McFerrin sang in the sweetest counterpoint the first prelude from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier.
Thank you.
The main event was Dvorak's elegiac cello concerto. With Xander conducting, Yo-Yo Ma played one of the most soulful singing performances I've ever heard. This heavenly music and music making is not just consoling. I think it makes us feel a little less helpless. We can say to ourselves, if the human spirit is capable of such sweetness and generosity, such harmony, there's still a chance it might survive.
Bach's Air in G, performed by Bobby McFerrin and cellist Yo-Yo Ma and Ben Xander. Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Thanks to member station WGBH in Boston for supplying the tapes of these performances. We wondered what it was like for musicians who were performing those first few nights of the war. Cellist Yo-Yo Ma is with us on the telephone. Hi, how are you?
Hi.
You know, I know a jazz musician who had a gig the night that the war started, and he went, you know, he showed up for the gig and the club owner paid him and then sent him home saying that he didn't have the heart for music. And I was wondering if you ever felt those first few days of the war that you didn't have the heart to perform.
Well, actually, it's a funny thing that you ask, because the concert that we played on January 20th, we started rehearsing the night that the bombing started. And I heard it on the way to the rehearsal hall. And I think that just my heart just sank, and I too didn't want to play any music or listen to it. I just wanted to be glued to the radio and hear everything. But the orchestra was there, and we started rehearsing the Dvorak concerto, and somehow the first 20 minutes were very difficult. You know, nobody wanted to play. It was terrible. But I think music has a way sometimes of reaching into our deepest selves, and perhaps into our deepest fears or the unknown, and somehow throughout, after about 20 minutes, I think we all realized that this music is what makes us, identifies our feelings and identifies the unknown for us and tragedy for us. And I think by the end of the rehearsal, all of us as a group, and there were about, you know, 70 or 80 of us rehearsing, thought that the music made it possible for us to go on and to for a little while into the our regular lives.
How often have you performed since the war started?
I guess before the war, I performed actually quite a lot, and I played a lot of solo Bach, which is interesting in that Bach, I think, is an amazing composer in that he's there's a spiritual element. It was secular music, but it also had a sense of healing to his music. And everywhere I went, there was at least one movement or one suite that I dedicated to as a prayer for peace. And I think I can't tell you what emotion it was to say those words and then to play the music, because I think there was a true communion of people listening and playing and the music that, again, that for a moment gave us a sense of inner peace amidst all the turmoil. But since the time, since the war started, I was supposed to go to Israel on the 21st, and every day before, we were wondering, you know, should I go, should I not go? And I have a lot of friends there, and as you know, Zubin Mehta from the New York Philharmonic went fairly soon after the war started, and finally it was canceled because there were no public concerts happening at that time. So obviously, I'm not playing right now, because the tour has been canceled.
Have you been practicing any more or less since the war started?
I think I feel also a little paralyzed by everything that's going on, and I think after feeling that way, I realized that it's actually better to do something, to act or even to think, rather than be numbed. And in that sense, I've been working fairly hard, not always on the cello, but just, you know, either writing things or just studying and, you know, just keeping busy.
Yo-Yo Ma, thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with us.
Thank you very much.
Cellist Yo-Yo Ma. Coming up, we talk about war-related comic strips with Bill Griffith, creator of Zippy the Pinhead. This is Fresh Air. Zippy the Pinhead speaks in non sequiturs, but his creator, Bill Griffith, is trying to make sense of the war. Griffith is a comic strip artist who has his roots in underground comics. He's now syndicated in 65 major dailies. It was for Zippy that Griffith coined the phrase, "Are we having fun yet?" Zippy is a hulking character with a pear-shaped head who wears a flowing polka-dot muumuu and styrofoam shoes. I asked Griffith what it was like trying to figure out what he wanted to draw in the first few days after the war started.
Well, it was almost as if I had no choice. I was pretty much forced into addressing the war just out of the kind of obsession I was having about it, watching the TV like everybody else, glued to my set. And since my strip has a kind of a diary-like quality anyway, there's a very little distance between what's happening to me and what I'm thinking and then the strip I do that day.
Let me ask you to describe your strip, Early Casualty, which I imagine is one of the first ones you did.
Yeah. It's the second one. The first one I did was about my morning walk when I encountered a children's peace march, and I did something about that. Anyway, the next day I sat down at the drawing table, trying desperately to think up something funny to say about the war, which is, of course, a futile effort. So instead of trying to think about something funny, I just did a strip about trying to think about something funny. So I've got myself at the drawing table looking kind of glassy-eyed with F-15 jets screeching over my drawing table and the TV set on next to me, and I'm staring at my blank paper saying, "Gotta be funny, so there's a war going on, gotta be funny." And the next panel, there are Scud missiles heading for me, three or four other F-15s dropping their payloads over my inkwell. And the last panel, I have a battle helmet on, looking even more glassy-eyed, saying, "Funny, gotta be funny."
Well, is that the way you feel, that you have to be funny, or is there something besides funny that you could do to comment on what's happening?
Well, it's funny is what people expect out of a comic strip. It's not what I always give them,
right?
But that's what they want. And it seemed like the only sane thing to do at that moment was to make a comment on the fact that I couldn't possibly be funny that day.
Now, Zippy, who is one of your two main characters, is not very bright. He's a kind of mass media sponge. As you once described it, he talks like a remote control device on your TV set. And to him, TV sitcom characters are as real as family members are to you or me. Now, this is the kind of war where you really are dealing with mass media. I mean, TV has been what everybody's been plugged into. So how are you working with that and Zippy?
Well, it was it was weird. It was like the first Scud missile kind of knocked the non-sequiturs right out of Zippy's mind. I've established in the past, to people who follow my strip religiously, you'll know that when Zippy gets angry, which happens very rarely, but when he gets angry, he becomes irrational.
He becomes rational?
Rational, which is kind of a frightening thought for Zippy and for his readers, I think. So in these strips that I've been doing since the war, Zippy actually has slightly stepped out of character. I mean, I have one strip called Ziplomacy where he's actually turned into a superhero and he visits General Schwarzkopf and Saddam Hussein both and tells him to basically cut it out. And there's absolutely no Zippy-like qualities to his personality at that moment. It's kind of, just as the war is a chilling thing to me, it kind of does a chilling thing to Zippy's personality as well.
Read the strip Ziplomacy for us.
Okay, the first panel is a crowd of people either somewhere in Riyadh or Tel Aviv looking up at the sky, a la the way people would look up at the sky spotting Superman flying across the horizon. And the first guy says, "Look, up in the sky, is it a Scud missile?" And a woman says, "Is it a cruise missile?" And a third person wearing a gas mask says, "Is it a patriotic anti-missile missile?" And the next panel shows Zippy as Zipman, which is where his musculature has been highly defined, wearing a tight polka dot suit with a big Z across his chest. And someone screams, "No, it's Zipman streaking across the Saudi desert." And the next panel, at the top, it says, "Soon at the Allied Forces High Command." And there's Zippy looking very angry and serious, staring into the eyes of a sweaty General Schwarzkopf. And he says, "I want this war stopped, General. It's giving me a big headache." And the general says, "Whatever you say, Zipman, my mistake." And the last panel, above it, it says, "And 5 minutes later, at Iraqi Republican Guard headquarters, Zippy is confronting Saddam Hussein, who's looking equally sweaty, and Zipman says, 'Bag the megalomania, Saddam. This jihad thing is one large drag.' And Saddam replies, 'I apologize, Zipman. I see now that my actions are unhip and that peace would be totally cool.'" And at the bottom, the sort of the tagline says, "Wouldn't it be fabulous if Zipman was in charge?"
My guest is Bill Griffith, creator of the comic strip Zippy the Pinhead. More with Griffith in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. Today we'll have news of the briefing in Riyadh by General Norman Schwarzkopf, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. Central Command, in which he claimed that the air war against Iraq over the past 2 weeks has been extremely successful, and he provided a bit more detail and video than had been seen before. Also, we'll be hearing an interview with Evelyn Glennie, a very interesting young percussionist from Scotland that I'd like you to hear. Also, of course, a reaction to President Bush's State of the Union address.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Bill Griffith is my guest. He's creator of the syndicated comic strip Zippy the Pinhead. Do you have a comic that you've recently done that you could read for us, one of the new ones? One of the brand new ones?
Yeah, well, this one is for a Sunday strip. And it's the first panel, Griffy, my alter ego, and Zippy are sitting by a sort of a babbling brook in an idyllic setting, and Griffy says, "It's good to get away from the war for a while, Zip." And Zippy says, "No one should have to see that much computer graphics." In the second panel, Griffy says, "But it isn't just happening on the tube." And Zippy, looking rather befuddled, says, "It isn't?" Then Griffy says, "It's happening to real people on all sides of the bloody conflict." And Zippy says, "How old is Iraq, Griffy?" And Griffy looks towards him and says, "Well, Iraq traces its roots as far back as ancient Mesopotamia, I guess." And in the last panel, their idyllic scene is somewhat disturbed by, on the horizon, by a burning building and a few rockets' red glares. And Zippy, looking off into the wreckage, says, "Wasn't Mesopotamia the cradle of world civilization, Griffy?" And Griffy responds, "From the cradle to the grave, Zippy."
Ooh.
So.
Is there anything about the war that you would like to add?
Well, there was one little thing, and I probably will be stepping on somebody's toes by saying it, but There was an article in the San Francisco Examiner last week about me and a bunch of other cartoonists, Matt Groening and Charles Schultz, and they asked their... the paper called these cartoonists and asked them what they were doing about the war, if anything.
Mm-hmm.
And Mort Walker, who does Beetle Bailey, I'm looking at the article here, said something about, long ago I decided to keep my characters in boot camp over here, a broader experience, which is more peaceful by nature. And I found that kind of morally chilling, that I know, I mean, Mort Walker and Beetle Bailey are an institution, and to expect to see them do biting, relevant political satire is not necessarily a logical thing. But I couldn't help but think that cartoonists, since they have a political platform, in effect, just by being in a daily newspaper, have that responsibility. I actually did a strip called Are We Debriefed Yet?, in which Zippy drags Beetle Bailey into the war. And I don't know what's going to happen with this one. I have not sent this to the syndicate yet. I have Griffey saying, Zippy, what do you think you're doing? And Zippy says, I'm dragging Beetle Bailey into the Gulf War. And he's actually dragging Beetle Bailey. And Griffey says, don't you think that's a moral decision each and every person has to make on his or her own? And Zippy says, this is Beetle's chance to be on the cutting edge of hard-hitting military satire. Beetle is sleeping during this entire sequence. And Griffey says, maybe he just wants to live out his days peacefully in the idyllic boot camp of his mind. And Zippy, straining as he still is trying to pull Beetle into the strip, says, sorry, these are the times that try cartoon characters' souls. And Beetle suddenly wakes up and says, golf? I thought he said golf. And then at the bottom, I say, sorry, Mort.
Could you get sued for this if it's printed?
No, I don't think so. But it's conceivable that Mort Walker, being the power that he is at King Features, that I might get a phone call about this.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Bill Griffith is the creator of the syndicated comic strip Zippy the Pinhead. Griffith works on a 6-week deadline, but he's asked several papers to substitute his new war comics for the comics that were originally scheduled to run. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Roberta Shurrock directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we examine the complicated alliances in the Middle East with Patrick Seale, author of a biography of Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. Also, military historian Michael Howard discusses the sacrifices of war. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the first pro and anti-Gulf War songs. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
Coming up on 91FM, we have a special program for you. Tenor Luciano Pavarotti hosts an evening of opera live from Lincoln Center. It's a special digital...